शरणवघोरयकर्णधारस्वरूपः नमोऽस्तु रामकृष्णाय तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः. Salutations to Sri Ramakrishna, the Guru who is the helmsman to guide our boat to the other shore, crossing the turbulent sea of the world. Good morning, everyone. We are starting a new topic. This morning it'll be a short two-part series. Some of you who have better memories than I do will remember that we went through this a few years ago. This breaker of this world's chain is a reference to the arati song that we sing every night, Kandana. The actual words, breaker of this world's chain, this is the English translation that was done by Swami Prabhupadanandaji with the help of Christopher Isherwood. And all of our centers in Southern California recite the English translation of this together with the original. So we're all used to this. It's not a 100% literal translation, but used to this phrase, breaker of this world's chain, we adore thee. It's a very beautiful translation that we have of that. Anyhow, most of you know that this is the hymn that's sung in practically all of our centers, perhaps with the only exception of Mayavati, at least in India, at the time of the evening worship, arati, when we wave the lights and do other offerings. This is one of the nicest experiences that anyone can have if you go to Belarmat and you watch the evening arati here and you hear the hundreds of voices singing these hymns together, not simply the Kandana, but then Om Hring Ritam and Sarva Mangala Mangali, all three of them together. Belarmat, especially on certain occasions, there'll be someone playing, if not tabla, maridanga, actually, or pakuaj is more traditional with this type of music, and even violin. Sometimes you'll have a violin player there. And there are two Western-style organs on both sides of the temple when you go in. Someone will be playing the organs also. And it's a tremendously inspiring experience. If you go on a big celebration day, it's a very strange thing. I don't know how many of you have ever witnessed this, but there'll be so many people in the back who are singing the whole thing that they can't really hear the monks in the front who are singing. So they'll end up at a different speed and on a different note. So you'll hear, kind of, if you're in the middle, you'll hear both together, almost like an echo and a little bit higher. It's somehow eerily beautiful. It's a wonderful experience. So if you're ever there on say, Durga Puja or Thakur's Puja, Titi Puja or something, try to sit in that in-between area so you can hear both sides. The arati celebration itself, service, is also very wonderful. We do it in our centers, but it's done throughout India, in temples. It's mostly waving of lights, but then there are other things that can be done. We don't do it here except on puja days. But generally, there'll be we have our five wicks. There'll even be places with 108, and you'll see it if you ever go to Rishikesh or Hardwar, you'll see it done to Ganga itself. You know, and many of these Puruhits there together with these huge 108 arati lamps, that's also a tremendous thing. And of course, they'll sing the North Indian Jaya Jagadish Hare, that which is also very, very wonderful. So this is the arati service. It's generally sung at the same time that the offerings are made. We sing it afterwards because we don't do the whole five vitamin everything. That's also done sometimes. Now, many of the traditions that we have in our order developed over time. It's not like from the very first day we had the present arati that we have and singing the same three hymns. We know that these young monks of the order, they didn't have a blueprint. They didn't know what to do, really. They had to develop their own style of puja, even their own style of addressing each other. They didn't know what to call each other. In the beginning, it was Narin Babu, Shashi Babu, Sharad Babu. And then one of the newcomer monks, Swami Sadananda, he introduced this style of Maharaj, Narin Maharaj and Shashi Maharaj, that before that they didn't have that. So these things developed over a period of time. And the same thing with the Arati service that we have in our order. The ritualistic worship, of course, in the beginning was always done by Swami Ramakrishnananda. And he came from an orthodox Brahmin family. He knew a lot of these things. So many of the elements of worship, puja, and everything we do were taken from traditional things, only some names are changed to protect the innocent. So we substitute the name of Sri Ramakrishna for, can be any worship of Shiva, Durga, anything. So he was the one who first started that when the first monastery was established in Baranagar, Baranagar Mutt. That was 1886, very shortly after Sri Ramakrishna passed away, until 1892. Then from 92 to 97, it shifted again to Alambazar. And then for a short time, if you go to Belarmat, south of the campus there, that Nilambar Babu's garden house, where Holy Mother also stayed, that was a temporary monastery. And when the property, Belarmat property, was bought, the monks stayed there. Now, that's a little important here because that's the period during which Swamiji composed this hymn. So while they were at that garden house at that time. So in the early days, they knew about this waving of lights, but they didn't have any special hymn to sing or anything. As monks, there's always some special devotion to Shiva. Shiva is kind of the presiding deity. He's the ideal sannyasi. So, and they also looked upon Sri Ramakrishna as Shiva himself somehow. So in the beginning, they would chant, Jaya Shiva Omkara, Bhaja Shiva Omkara, Brahma Vishnu Sada Shiva, Hara 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 Mahadeva. That's what they did during the waving of the lights. And this was taken from what's done at the Vishwanath temple, perhaps the most famous temple, at least to Shiva, in Kashi. This is from the history of the Ramakrishna mission. After establishing the main monastery of the Ramakrishna Mutt at Belur, Swami Vivekananda introduced certain rituals which have now become a tradition in all the branches as well. One of these is a short worship to Sri Ramakrishna at dusk, followed by waving of lamps and other puja materials before the deity. This is our arati. To the accompaniment of music, Swamiji himself composed the text of the song and also set it to music. It is now well known as Kandana Bhavabandana Stotra and is sung all over the world in the monasteries of the Ramakrishna order during evening service. Then, of course, we sing Om Ring Ritam after that and Sarva Mangala Mangalye. So really the first two are to Sri Ramakrishna. And then the third to Holy Mother, even though it's a hymn addressed to Durga, because she's looked upon as the living Durga. There was a nice incident that took place. Holy Mother, I believe, attended Durga Puja twice, at least twice, at Belarmat. And on one occasion, Swami Sharadananda told the pujari at the end of the puja to offer a coin to Mother. Now, this is traditionally done in the worship. So he took the coin, and he went, and then he had this doubt. Did he mean offer it to the image of Durga in the temple, or did he mean to Holy Mother? So he went back, and he asked him, did you mean to give in the temple to Durga, or to give to Holy Mother? And he said, you give to Holy Mother. We look upon her as living Durga. So when we sing that hymn to Durga, or Kali, you can say that we consider that to be offering to Holy Mother as well. Now, when I was researching this the first time, I contacted Swami Premayanandaji. Now, Swami Premayanandaji passed away a few years ago. He was vice president of the order and very instrumental in our center. It was because of him that we have this beautiful image of Sri Ramakrishna. He arranged everything. He oversaw it. He sent someone to make sure it was being done nicely. He had great affection for me and for this center. So I wrote to him, because he was a very good historian also, about the Khandana, what was, you know, the history behind it and everything. And he wrote back to me, "When Swamiji returned to India after his first visit to the West, the monastery was then at Alambazar, and Shashi Maharaj was looking after the seva and puja of Sri Sri Thakur. Immediately after his return to Calcutta, Swamiji sent Shashi Maharaj to Madras. Baburam Maharaj succeeded Shashi Maharaj. In the meantime, the monastery was shifted to Nilambar Babu's garden house at Bellore. Swamiji also was there at that time. At Nilambar Babu's house, also a small shrine was set up, and daily worship, etc., of Sri Sri Thakur was conducted as usual. At that time, Swamiji composed the Aratrika, Aratrika means Arati, song, Khandana Bhava Bandhana, to be sung at the time of Aratrika. But he did not compose the song as we sing it now. He composed a few stanzas then, and after every stanza, Namo Namo Prabhu was sung. So that portion was to be repeated. But the monks and brahmacharins who were actually singing the song during Aratrika found it difficult to sing that way, the way that Swamiji suggested. So after some time, they told Swamiji about their difficulties. In the meantime, the mutt had been shifted to Bellore mutt. At Bellore mutt, Swamiji composed a few more stanzas and added to the original. And Namo Namo portion shifted to just before Dhe 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 Langa, as we sing it now. That is what we do now. That is the story behind the Aratrika song. So that's just a little history that we have. But what we know is that it's a beautiful composition. We've seen now so many poems that Swamiji composed in English. This is Bengali, but it's a highly Sanskritized Bengali. There's one style of poetry or song, you can say, that is written in such a way that most people who know some modern Indian language will understand it. It's Sanskrit words that don't have Sanskrit endings and that they're commonly found in all of the different languages. So this is, technically it's in Bengali because there are a few verbs and things, but otherwise it's almost a pure Sanskrit type of hymn. But the musical aspect of it is also something tremendous. Three different rhythms and tunes that we have, and it's written in Dhrupad style. Swamiji, as a boy, Narendra, was trained in music. He wasn't just a natural musician. He had a formal training, and he learned this. He was very fond of this Dhrupad. I don't know what it means, some classical style that goes with this Bridangam and Pakuaj and everything. So it's meant to be sung in a certain way and to be accompanied by certain instruments. So you play tabla along with it, but it's not really meant for tabla. It's meant for this muridanga. So what I would like to do today, the remaining portion, and the next time we meet, is to go through the hymn, Khandana Bhavantana, verse by verse. We'll go through the whole thing and do half of it this morning, and we'll finish next time. And pay special attention to the specific incidents in Sri Ramakrishna's life. If anyone is interested in following along, yeah, we have, look under the seats. If you see that booklet with the dark red cover, you can follow along. So it starts out, the first line, Khandana Bhava Bandhana, Jaga Vandana Vanditomai Niranjana Nara Rupa Dhara Nirguna Gunamai. And because some people will claim it's really Bengali, some pronounce it like Bengali. We generally, and Swami Swamiji told me once, he said, pronounce it like Sanskrit, then everyone can understand. Doesn't matter whether you think it's Bengali or not. So it starts with the main theme of the hymn. Now, this, of course, is a hymn to Sri Ramakrishna, but there's no mention of him. His name doesn't occur anywhere, and it's actually addressed to him. So it's in praise of him and addressed to him, as if we're singing to him and praising him. Vandi, I praise you, praising him as we're sitting right before him. So it starts with the main theme. Now, the main theme is that Sri Ramakrishna represent various different levels of divinity, we can say, or we can look at him in different ways. When we think of Sri Ramakrishna, who do we think of? We have the historical Sri Ramakrishna and that particular Leela that took place in Kamarpukur, Dakshineshwar, Shyampukur, Kashipur. We have that Sri Ramakrishna. We have Sri Ramakrishna as divine incarnation. That means that also that Leela is part of it, but he came from someplace else. Then we have that Sri Ramakrishna who's Hridaya Kamalamadhyay, who dwells within the heart, who is the Antaryaman, who is the inner God, the inner controller. We have that Sri Ramakrishna, as we have Krishna in Gita, who is identified with Ishwara, the Lord of all creation. And then we have that Sri Ramakrishna, who is Brahman itself. So in this hymn, as well as in Om Hring Ritam, Swamiji emphasizes that fact. When we think of Sri Ramakrishna, we accept the whole package. We don't take one portion to the exclusion of another. Say we meditate on Sri Ramakrishna, we may be thinking of him in flesh and blood, existing at a certain time, but that doesn't mean we don't think of him as a avatara. We don't think of him as dwelling within the heart, as pure consciousness, as being one with Ishwara, the ground of the universe. Well, all of these things come together. So we have that here in this very first verse, that human aspect, that human form, avatar, the divine incarnation, then as a symbol of the personal God and as the supreme Brahman, all together. And if we think of him excluding one of them, we're not getting the full weight, as he used to say. We want to get the full weight of the bell fruit. So he's bhava bandhana kandana, literally kandana, breaking it into little pieces, this bondage of the world, or the bondage that we have. And what is this bondage that we have? Bondage means ignorance, it means attachment, it means all of the passions that keep us from acting freely. We react to things without even wanting to react in a particular way. All of these things represent bondage. Fear, doubt, all the passions, kam, krodh, all of these things. Lust, anger, greed, egotism, pride, and envy. What Thakur calls these six crocodiles, six alligators that are ready to devour us. This is all the bondage that we have. Now, how does he break this bondage? What's emphasized in this hymn is just through thinking of him, through remembering him. Now, we know that he had his way of doing it, and it was different with different people. His direct disciples, whatever little vestige of bondage there was, he could get rid of it in a touch. He had that power to do that. But for us, letting the mind dwell on him, thinking of it, that Leela, feeling that love, this has the power to dissolve this bonds of the world. So we try to think of him, redirect our passions towards him. He's the symbol, so that this is how we forge that attachment to God through Sri Ramakrishna or whoever our chosen deity is, but in this case with this hymn, through Sri Ramakrishna. And this is how we transform ourselves through meditation, through constant recollection on all of these aspects, on his divine personality, on his divine play, on his divine attributes, and on his divine teachings. So all of these together, seeing him in all these different levels also. He dwells within our hearts constantly. He's the witness. He's the inner controller, the Antaryamin. But he manifested at a particular time in a particular human form for us, for our benefit, not for any other reason. So all of these things, keeping them in mind, thinking about them, dwelling on these ideas, this is how that bondage slowly comes to break. He is Jagavandana, revered, honored, worshipped throughout the world. Now, this was his own prediction. You remember the one time he saw that photograph of himself. And in some type of ecstatic mood, he said, this will be worshipped from house to house. Gore, gore. Yeah, this is a picture. So he, and there was no trace of pride or ego or anything, but he just, he knew that. He knew who he was, and he knew why he came. So we find that how within how many years, 150 years, His worship now is found in every corner of the world. So really it became literally true. He understood that his name, that his teachings, that his personality would become known and respected throughout the world. And we can say through Swamiji, if not his name and his personality, the very liberal teachings that Swamiji brought regarding harmony of religions and everything. And these are commonly accepted now. So he literally Jagavandana, worshipped throughout the world. So Vandi Tomai, for all of these reasons, we also worship you. So this is where addressing Sri Ramakrishna. I worship thee, who is worshipped throughout the whole world, who is Niranjana, pure and stainless. Now, Sri Ramakrishna was pure to such an extent that he couldn't bear any impurity. He couldn't bear the touch of an impure person. His system was so sensitive to that. We may think that all of the direct disciples were very pure, and of course, from a relative point of view, they were immaculate. But from Sri Ramakrishna's point of view, even then he would make distinctions. One, Baburam, Swami Premananda. Baburam, Sri Ramakrishna used to say, was pure to his very bones. Others also in Niranjana, but especially this Baburam. So at different points in his life, he was more sensitive than others. Of course, in the beginning, before anyone came, Hridoy was there, who was a bit of a rascal. We know that. But somehow he would hold up Sri Ramakrishna when he went into Samadhi. In later days, it couldn't have happened. It had to be this Baburam. Even the other direct disciples, he would say, no, I want Baburam near me. I can't bear the touch of anyone and everyone. If I go into that state, then I need to be supported somehow. I want Baburam near me. So it's a very special aspect of the life of Swami Premananda, who was the embodiment of love. Swami Premananda, very wonderful soul. And it shows the extent of stainlessness and purity in the mind and heart of Sri Ramakrishna, that he was tremendously sensitive. If someone with any impure thought or stain of the heart came to him when he was in that very high mood, other times it was different, that very high mood, they wouldn't be able to touch him even. Then, Nara Rupa Dhara, assuming human form. Now, why mention this? Everyone assumes a human form. Because Swamiji is looking upon Sri Ramakrishna from the point of view of the divine incarnation. Now, there's a very subtle distinction. When Swamiji was with Sri Ramakrishna, still Narendra, at the very end of his life, there was a very touching incident when Narendra looked at him in that terrible pain and suffering and said, now alone, if in the midst of this tremendous suffering, he can declare that he's an incarnation of God, then alone will I believe it. So Sri Ramakrishna looked at him and said, oh, Naren, even now you have doubts. And then he said, he who was Rama, he who was Krishna, is now in this body, Sri Ramakrishna. Then he adds, but not in your Vedantic sense. Now, that means that each and every one of us can say we're incarnations of God. God alone dwells within each and every being. But what he meant was this Nara Rupa Dhara. It meant that in a very special sense, the personal aspect of God, however we understand it, Ishvara, takes human form, Nara Rupa Dhara, at a particular time, for a particular reason, according to a particular special need. So, Nara Rupa Dhara. Then, at the same time, he's Nirguna and Gunamai. So when we speak about him as Nirguna, then we're thinking of Sri Ramakrishna as a Brahman. This is Nirguna Brahman. Otherwise, he had qualities, he had characteristics. But Nirguna, in the sense that who he was in essence, was nothing but one with God and the highest aspect, this pure consciousness. This pure consciousness. So the worship of Sri Ramakrishna means also worship of the Nirguna Brahman, Brahman without any attributes, pure, perfect, transcendent, absolute consciousness. Now, Swamiji likes to do this little play with gunas, the different meanings of gunas. So he says gunamai. That means he's the embodiment of the gunas. Now, the embodiment of the gunas means prakriti, nature. So he's both Brahman and Shakti together, both Brahman and Kali, as he used to say, the transcendent aspect and the immanent aspect, the unmanifest and the manifest, the one and the many, all of these together, Nirguna, Gunamai. We have this Gunamai, Divine Mother, considered Gunamai. The other meaning is, which we also find in Om Hring Ritam, he says, Gunerdiha, worshipped for his gunas. That means worshipped for his wonderful qualities, his virtues, and his for his love and his devotion and his sweetness and kindness and compassion, all of these things together. So it has both of those meanings. So here we see both Nirguna Brahman, Saguna Brahman, or Ishwara, or Divine Mother, all of that taken together in these two phrases, Nirguna, Gunamai. Then we get the phrase, Mochana Aghadushana. That means he releases us from this corrupting power of sin, or evil deeds, or however we understand it. He himself didn't like this word sin, this papa, this idea, but we do things that will have negative effects, and we get some negative karma from it. So this is our agha, or papa. So there is some karma that comes. Whatever we do, there's some result. If what we do is something harmful to someone else or harmful to ourselves, then some bad karma will come from that. Now, one of the special powers of a divine incarnation or a very highly evolved saint is that they can take karma. This is called vicarious atonement in Christianity. Jesus was the ultimate example of this, that by accepting the agony of the cross, he took on all of the sins for all of humankind. He was the sacrificial lamb somehow. But we see this idea in the lives of Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother, especially those two, that they had the power to relieve someone of some of their bad karma. And during their lifetime, they would do it in such a way that they would have to take it on. And in the case of Sri Ramakrishna, he had some disciples who had led very questionable lives. Of course, the main example is Girish Chandra Ghosh. And at one time, Sri Ramakrishna even said, "You see this suffering I have in the throat, it's taking on the sins of Girish." So they had that power. And we may say that, well, doesn't this contradict this theory of karma? This idea, prarabdha karma, that we're suffering because of things we've done in the past, there's no way to get out of it. Now, Sri Ramakrishna and Holy Mother, they had this theory that there's no way to get rid of prarabdha karma completely, but it can be lessened. It can be lessened to a tremendous extent, so that if, suppose we did something horrible in the past lifetime and we were destined to be killed by a sword in this lifetime. Through that tremendous love and devotion and worship, surrendering to these tremendous personalities, divine personalities, that can be reduced to a little pinprick. So they paid respect to the doctrine of prarabdha karma because they didn't say you can eliminate it completely, but lessened to such a tremendous degree. So this was, again, something literally true in Sri Ramakrishna's life, mochana akadushana, that he could remove some of the karma from others, and while he was alive, he had to suffer for it. And this is at least is one of the reasons why, or how we explain why he should have such a terrible suffering from the throat cancer. Then, jagabhushana, adornment of the world. Sri Ramakrishna, he was like a precious gem that should be kept in a glass case. Swami Brahmananda, he made a very nice statement that he should be very carefully kept. They have this some type of cotton that they use sometimes if they're very nice fruit, delicate fruit, grapes or something that they'll put it on, or to keep, you know, hidden in a glass case. Keshav also said that. He said to the other disciples, you don't know who he is, how precious he is, a precious gem, how he should be kept, you know, so carefully preserved, Jagabhushana, as an adornment of the world. Then Chidghanakai. This is also a very interesting phrase. His body, kaya, his body is chidghana. It's a type of condensed mass of consciousness itself. Now, according to Advaita Vedanta, and also the Sri Ramakrishna's direct vision, this was, he would go into a certain mood sometimes and say, yes, I can see individual people and everything, but I see really it's just all chidghana, chinmaya. It's all just consciousness in some congealed form, some thickened form somehow. Almost like this sky that we see is like this consciousness, and it has some moisture in it. In some places, the moisture will condense just enough so that we'll see a cloud. There'll be some visible form. But it's nothing but sky. It's nothing but moisture in some visible way. So somehow this idea that this consciousness can take some type of visual form. And this whole universe is like that. That nothing but consciousness. If we analyze a dream, what are the objects in the dream made out of? We have to go back to consciousness. There's no physical thing there. So according to the strict Advaita Vedanta, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahman, everything we see is nothing but Brahman itself. It's nothing but consciousness. But here, the slightly different meaning with regard to Sri Ramakrishna himself. Some very particular type of meaning, because he seemed to be able, after his passing away, to make himself present. Holy Mother saw him on several occasions. Others also, when she was in Kamarpukur, she had the vision of Sri Ramakrishna. Other times, even on the train, with regard to her bangles, that he said, no, don't take them off, put them back on. And she could feel his hand even on her hand that way. Something so tangible that we wondered, did he actually take some chidghana form that way? Did he actually appear? Now, we may think that these are all just subjective visions. Now, the subjective vision means that only one person will have it. There was an incident very shortly after Sri Ramakrishna passed away. Swamiji, Swami Vivekananda, was with his good friend and devotee Harish. And Swamiji saw something, some light, some figure that he saw. Oh, Sri Ramakrishna himself has come like that. But he didn't say anything because he thought that only he could see it. And this Harish would think that he's, you know, imagining something like that. But Harish himself cried out, what is that, Narin? Look. And it said that apparition came within a few feet of Narin and then vanished. Narendra was certain it was Sri Ramakrishna assuming a chidghana kai, or a spiritual body. Now, even in his lifetime, we have the other fascinating incident where Vijay Krishna Goswami, all the way in Dhaka, not that distance makes any difference, telling Sri Ramakrishna when he saw him in Calcutta, when I was in Dhaka, and then he couldn't go further after that. But then he explained that he saw him as in flesh and blood, as if in flesh and blood there. Now, Narendra was there, and they were discussing it afterwards. And Narendra said, how can I doubt his words? How many times I've seen him that way? So how we explain it is a different story, but on some level, he had this power to take this chidghana kai, this body made of pure consciousness. Right? Then, vimala nayana vikshane moha jai. His eyes were pure. That means he saw everything as pure. Not that he wasn't aware of impurity, but he didn't have that judgmental attitude that we have. This whole teaching of Holy Mother, don't see the faults of others, that was from him, of course. He also emphasized that, and saw everything as divine. So that's this Vimala Nayanar, this purity of vision, to see God in everything and God in everyone. And Swamiji, of course, had this very same thing, to see that same God dwelling in the thief, in the cheat, in the liar, in the rogue, in the scoundrel, the same God. So this is a purity of vision that allows that. And how did he get that? Gyananjana. This anjana is this black lining that they put around the eyes of children very often, or someone who has some eye problem, and it makes the eyes tear. And anything that's impurity in the eye will come out through the tears. And Sri Ramakrishna used to say that the tears of the eyes will cleanse the stain of the heart. Whatever is there, this weeping for God is a very important thing. So this idea that the eyes are lined with this anjana, collyrium, they say, of knowledge. So it was because he had that insight, that wisdom, that knowledge, that everything is divine, that he had that purity of vision. Now also, we know that there is something very special about the glance of Sri Ramakrishna, not from his side, from our side. We hear about these very special souls. They can confer liberation or some spiritual experience by a word, by a touch, or by a glance even. And Sri Ramakrishna had that ability. We know with regard to Swamiji and so many of the direct disciples and others also, that some casual touch, he would simply touch them or stroke the body or go like this, something like that, and they would have some type of spiritual experience. But this idea of a glance, we find this again towards the end of Sri Ramakrishna's life in Kashipur, when Sri Ramakrishna would summon Swamiji Narendra to his side every day for hours, and he would give him certain types of instructions, what to do after he passed away, how to keep the young boys together, to start a monastic community, how to spread these teachings, all of these things. He gave Swamiji so many instructions during that period. Now, Swamiji says that suddenly, one day he was sitting next to him that day, suddenly Sri Ramakrishna glanced at him. He said he glanced at me in an intense way. And after looking at Narendra that way, then Narendra lost all outer consciousness, and of course didn't know how long he stayed in that state, but when he came back to ordinary consciousness, or as close as he came to ordinary consciousness, he found Sri Ramakrishna weeping there. And he said, "Now I have given you all of my spiritual powers, and I'm nothing but a penniless beggar, penniless fakir," he said. So this was through a glance, not even touching him, just intently looking at him, that he was able to raise Narendra's consciousness to this super conscious level and transfer his power to him that way. Bhaswara Bhavasagara Chira Unmada Prema Patar, ocean of light and ecstasy. So here's a Bhaswara, this is this brilliant shining sun, and Bhava Sagara. So this ocean of light and ecstasy, ever lashed into waves of intoxicating love. Chira Unmada. This mad play of waves going back and forth of this divine love. And this, of course, was one of the most distinctive aspects of Sri Ramakrishna's personality. He was even called as Bhagavata Thakur, the mad Thakur of Dakshineswar, the mad priest of Dakshineswar, because his behavior was so eccentric. And we know even his own family members suspected him of going off his head. And this was the whole reason he was brought back to Kumarpukur. And of course, in India, they think the solution to every problem is get the fellow married. So this is why they arranged his marriage to Holy Mother, to bring his mind down to the world so he could act like a normal person and get a job and do all of those things. But he went through this long period of divyonmala, of divine madness. because his mind was so filled with God and filled with longing for God realization that he didn't care for anything else. What else can we call a bit madness? He says that for 6 long years, he could barely take any food, and the eyes would not close for sleep even. So naturally, he was like a ghoul during that period. Hair grew long. He would stay in the forest area north of the temple garden, which people didn't like to go to, and just call ma, ma, ma. People thought he was completely off his rocker. They thought he was completely mad. So this Chira Unmada, but we know that this is a state, a very high state of God realization, and it was really because of the Bhairavi Brahmani that when she came, she was able to compare all of the different aspects of this madness, all of the different physical traits, all of the weeping and even burning sensation and blood coming from the pool, all of these things, compare that to what was written about Radha and what took place in the life of Chaitanya Deva. She was able to convince everyone that this is a divine madness. It's not an ordinary madness. And Sri Ramakrishna himself thought, am I going mad? So when he heard her say that, then he was really relieved to a very great extent. So really, she played a very important role that way. And still, I mean, now we know that this behavior was really because his mind was pitched to such a high state. And when Sri Ramakrishna used to talk about the different types of God-realized souls, he would say some are like ghouls, Pishachavat. Some are like children, Balakavat. Some are like Jadavat, like a dead, or like a stump of a tree or something, unmoving, lost in samadhi, and Unmalavat. Some behave like madmen. So this is something that's understood in India. There was an interesting thing. You remember Meher Baba? He was very, very popular in the 60s. I don't know if it's true. They said that he went all through India to all of these places where people were kept in kind of insane asylums. And he would go and say, no, this one is really a very high soul. This one is a high soul. They shouldn't be in here. They appear to be, it appears to be ordinary madness, but it's something else. He had that ability, apparently. Then, Bhaktarjana Yugala Charana Tarana Bhavapar. His holy feet, Yugala Charana, so his 2 feet, it means taking refuge at his feet, are this gift that is granted to those who are devoted to him, and they will take us across, the Tarana. They become like this boat that can carry us across this Bhavapar, to the other shore of this world. So we talk about his feet. That means refuge. That means that we surrender ourselves to him, and he becomes like a steamship. He used to use that example. He would say that there are some souls that, yes, they can float across to the other side like a little piece of driftwood, but if a big bird sits on it, it'll sink. It can't take anyone else, but a steamship can carry hundreds and hundreds of people. So he was like that big steamship to take us from one side to the other. That means from bondage to liberation, from ignorance to knowledge, from darkness to light. Then, feet. This was another curious thing about Sri Ramakrishna. We can take this literally, Yugala Charana, that is his feet. He had this power to touch someone. He would use his foot very often, just casually. Someone sitting there and just casually put his foot there and give them some spiritual experience. And Dr. Sharkar didn't like it, but it was a fact. And I mean, sometimes he would touch with the hand, but very often it was with the foot. So why and how, we don't know. But this Yugala Charana was Bhaktarthi. This is something that is earned at a very great cost for the devotee. It's tremendous grace. If Sri Ramakrishna would do that on some very rare occasions, he placed his foot, someone would bow down and he would place his foot on their head. Very rare occasions. Of course, his feet are considered something holy in India that way. And then, Jrimbhita Yuga Ishwara Jagadishwara Yoga Sahai. He has manifested himself as the Yuga Ishwara, the Lord of the age, we can say. So we can say incarnation of the age that way. And Jagadishwara, so Lord of the universe. Why? Yoga Sahai, he's our aid to help us attain union with God. Now, we read about different reasons for the Lord taking human form. This is the whole concept of the avatara in the Puranas, in Gita. We have more this idea of dharma, that it's for the removal of this wave of adharma that's threatening to take over the world and the reestablishment of dharma, righteousness. Sri Ramakrishna didn't downplay that idea, but he didn't emphasize that idea. And he used to say with others, Chaitanya Dev especially, that he was an avatara of devotion. He was born for that purpose. He wasn't born for the sake of dharma. He was born to teach the world devotion, to teach the world the blessed name of God and kirtan and all of these other things. So we can say for Sri Ramakrishna that he was born to teach us how to attain union with God. Yoga Sahai. And all of the yogas. Yoga, it doesn't just mean meditation. It also means bhakti yoga, jnana yoga, raja yoga, karma, all of the different paths that we have. Nirodhana samahita mana nirakitava kripai. Nirodhana samahita mana. His mind was ever fixed, ever established in samadhi. Now, that doesn't mean that he didn't bring the mind down. The mind had to be brought down in order to talk to people. But he was established in samadhi to the extent that, like a helium balloon, all he had to do was let go of the string and it would go right up to the ceiling. So his mind was like that. That was the ordinary state. He had to pull the mind down. He would sometimes even force himself to have these little desires. I'll eat this, I'll drink water, I'll do that. Or to visit the devotees, or to go to the zoo, the circus, the play, all of these things. Otherwise, his mind would just go straight up to the ceiling. He would be lost in samadhi, which he didn't want, because he knew that he wasn't born for that reason. And he used to like to say that he didn't want to become sugar, the Ram Prasad song. He wanted to taste sugar. He wanted to enjoy the bliss of bhakti and bhakta, of devotion and company of devotees, these two things. But this was the nature of his mind, ever established in samadhi. Anything could trigger it. He talks about this uddipana. This is, again, something we only see in the lives of Chaitanya Deva and Radha. For some reason, Radha is considered the ideal. And then Chaitanya Deva also had that, and Sri Ramakrishna has it. This idea of one thing triggering something else. With Radha, of course, she would see a dark rain cloud, and she would think of Krishna, because that was the color of his complexion, and she would be gone. Or she would see a peacock. She would think he used to wear a peacock feather, like that. Same thing with Chaitanya Deva. If he saw the ocean when he was in Puri, he would think, oh, this is Yamuna, where Krishna would graze the cows, and he would be lost in ecstasy. And some people think he drowned that way. But he was, at least at one occasion, fished out. He wanted to be in a state of union with Krishna like that. So this was the state of Sri Ramakrishna's mind, like dry tinder. You could, with a little match to it, it would blaze up instantly. So his mind would instantly go into samadhi. Now, how do we know all of these things? Nirakitava kripai. We've seen it and understood it through your grace. We know these things, tava kripai, through your grace. Otherwise, how do we know these souls? Unless they reveal themselves to us, we can't recognize them. We can, of course, have some sense of their greatness and everything. But Sri Ramakrishna, this is why he used to reminisce so much. He used to talk about his spiritual experiences, so that we would have some glimpse through his grace of who he really was. Then, bhanjana dukha ganjana karuna ghana karma kathur. He destroys our sorrow. How does he do it? Because he was the opposite. He was ever blissful. He used to say, even as a boy, he wouldn't go anywhere where people weren't happy. He used to say that they're pigeons, happy pigeons, that they'll only go where there are other happy pigeons. He was like that. He couldn't bear to be with people who were very down and grave. He liked to be happy. He was carefree. He was like a child that way. So again, we meditate on him. That means that we think of that carefree nature of his, and we pick up that. It becomes infectious, and that destroys our sorrow. We really, if we're feeling a little depressed or something, yes, we just look at that face and that smile and think of the joy that he had, and it'll lift us up. He used to say that whatever I have, it's just as the father, the son, the children, they have a right to it. There's, through inheritance laws, whatever the father owns, the children have a right to it. So all of his treasures, all the treasures of God, we can say, all of that, they're our birthright. So we simply have to know how to accept them. Then he is the embodiment of compassion, karunaghana. And at the same time, karmakator. He was a tremendous worker. Now, what was karma for him? What was work for him? Talking day and night. Sometimes he would say 18 hours out of the day, he would talk almost nonstop, even when he could hardly talk. And sometimes just through signs. When we read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, M was very good at knowing what he was thinking, interpreting things. So he would say, the master said, by a sign. So he knew that even then, he didn't cease to work. He didn't cease to work because he saw people suffering. What did he say to Holy Mother? He said, you see these people of Calcutta, how they're suffering. Who is there to remove their misery? Can't you do something for them? You'll have to do something for them. So tremendously moved by the suffering of others, he worked ceaselessly. Then pranarpana jagata tarana krintana kali dor. Pranarpana, he offered his entire life for us. This is arpana. We do arpana, some type of offering. What was his offering? His life. And even his health, how much he had to suffer for us. Jagata tarana, again, to take us across to the other side. Krintana kali dor. This Kali Yuga. This Kali Yuga has certain characteristics to it. It's the lowest. This is where spirituality has reached its lowest ebb. It's very interesting, all of the different yugas, four different yugas, they all have their own characteristics. And Kali Yuga has this bondage. Door means a rope. So he was able to cut the bondage of this Kali Yuga. The Satya Yuga is the first. This is the Golden Age. And in this Golden Age, there are different practices for each one. Meditation, dhyana. Dhyana meditation is what's most appropriate for that age because people have a great deal of purity and spiritual power. Treta Yuga, they can't fix the mind so much, but they can do some type of spiritual practice, some type of offering, yajna, sacrifice. So that's considered because it's a little bit lower. Dwapara, then Archana, it's worship, but it doesn't involve all the formalities of the other. And what do we do in Kali Yuga? People don't have much ability to do anything. If they have something, they'll give it. So Dana. They say dana, this giving a charity, giving of alms, something like that, because there's this identification with the physical and the material in this age. This is why Sri Ramakrishna said so many times, onno goto pran, that the whole life is revolving around food and material things. So this Kali Yuga, characterized by ignorance, characterized by tamas, by an inability to practice spiritual disciplines the way these rishis of ancient days did. Sri Ramakrishna said that so many times, how they would sit for hundreds of years in meditation. It's impossible to do all of that. So he made it easy for us. He said, this is not a diabhakti. If we have this devotion in this age, if we have this purity, if we can even keep truthfulness for 12 years in Kali Yuga, we can attain God. So we find that there are certain advantages to being born in this age. is good. If we were born in an earlier age, we'd have to do much more. Here we get, yeah, we get the benefit of our weaknesses here. So all we have to do is to weep for God for 3 days, he says, or even 24 hours, sometimes, he says. Just have that tremendous longing. We don't have to sit from morning till night in meditation. We don't have to do tremendous austerities. We have to practice truthfulness. We have to practice devotion. We have to make some effort. But for Sri Ramakrishna, the main spiritual discipline of the Kali Yuga is yearning, longing for God. Longing for God and constant remembrance of God. Swami Vivekananda, of course, had the wonderful belief, conviction, that with the birth of Sri Ramakrishna, the Kali Yuga came to an end. And that his birth represents the beginning of Satya Yuga, of this golden age. That means, of course, it doesn't, if you go by the Puranic designations with years and everything, it doesn't work out that way. What it means is that he's ushered in a new age of spirituality from his very birth onward. So let us stop here, and we'll continue the next time we meet, and let us just take a few minutes for meditation now.
Sado ma sadgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma mrityum gamaya, avir mayeti, urudrayate dakshanam mukham, te namam pahi nityam. Om shanti shanti shanti, hari om tatsat. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om peace, peace, peace be unto all.